Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz. Today is Tuesday, January 17th, 2017, 3 days until the inauguration of Donald Trump. With me, as always, Noah C. Rothman, our assistant online editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Commentary Magazine, the monthly of analysis, criticism, and commentary from a conservative perspective, the most distinguished in America. Please join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we ask you to subscribe after you get a few free reads. And it's $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription. You can just go to Commentary Magazine and click on subscribe, or take those free reads and enjoy them before you subscribe. And please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and leave a review. If you leave a review with a lot of stars, it jumps us up in the rankings, which is nice, as is the fact that our audience is growing by leaps and bounds for this podcast. More than 30,000 people listening to it every time we record it, which we're very grateful for. Gentlemen, Donald Trump had quite a weekend. So he began by getting into a fight with John Lewis, the civil rights icon, after Lewis called him illegitimate. He went on again to attack Saturday Night Live before the release of an interview with the Sunday Times, in which he seemed to panic German Chancellor Angela Merkel about the future of NATO, and told Bob Costa of the Washington Post that he wanted health insurance for everybody, which seems to suggest Obamacare Plus rather than the repeal of Obamacare, and the and an effort to scale back this wildly ambitious death spiral that Obamacare has gone into, and then called into question with the Wall Street Journal a plan devised by House Republicans to come up with some kind of border adjustment fee that would stand in for a tariff on Mexican goods, so that he could get some kind of a tariff on Mexican goods without it being called a tariff, which, of course, can really only be levied on Mexico and other countries should there be A, legislation, and B, in the case of Mexico, the literal repeal of the North American Free Trade Agreement. So we have policy called into question, we have temperament called into question, and we have a potential worldwide political crisis, all simply from the musings and sort of, you know, off-the-cuff remarks of someone who you don't still, he's going to be president in 3 days, and you still don't know what to take seriously, what to take literally, what not to take literally, what not to take seriously. So, Abe, what of all of these many things worries you the most, would you say?
Well, you know, I think they sort of all worry me, or they all don't, or we just don't know. Because, as you say, you know, we're coming to the end of the Trump stage two here. You know, he was an unprecedented candidate. Now he is the most destabilizing tweeter the world has ever seen. And in a few days, he will be the president. And what does he bring to that to phase three? I suppose the international relations, I suppose the NATO stuff, because it's one thing for him to want to remake how the United States does things and our political culture. I think I'm somewhat sympathetic to that idea. But when you have him thinking about our adversaries and foreign powers, I think he has no sense of what they are actually pursuing, how they think of the United States, and what our role is in response to them. It's not we have policies that aren't just matters of inertia that need overturning.
I mean, I'm concerned about this as well, but I actually find the healthcare remarks the most astounding. That's what he's been saying now for 2 years, that he wants to repeal and replace Obamacare. And if his idea of repealing and replacing Obamacare is to provide health insurance for all, that is not only not a repeal of Obamacare, it's an expansion of Obamacare. It can only be done, as a matter of fact, if you go to a single payer system. So does this mean that we have a president coming into office who doesn't understand the core nature of his signature policy claim, which was his signature policy claim? The problem with Obamacare, as we know, is as we go into 2017, there is a the imbalance between the cost of fulfilling all the Obamacare promises and the cost of the policies that have to be paid for by the people who are going to pay for the 20 million plus people who are now getting insurance who themselves aren't necessarily paying the full freight, particularly the ones who have joined through Medicaid. That is the famous death spiral that people were warning about from the beginning and made even more pronounced by the fact that the Supreme Court in its decision affirming the constitutionality of Obamacare said it would not be constitutional to penalize states for refusing to follow the orders of the federal government by using punitive measures to deny them access to resources. So we are heading toward the death spiral, and if you were to take Trump's words either literally or seriously, he wishes not only to hasten the death spiral but to deepen it.
More worryingly, I guess, is this notion that Tom Price, or Health Secretary nominee Tom Price, is sort of being kept out of the loop, according to some reporting. And they suggest that this has more to do with the fact that they're trying to, I guess, keep him sort of isolated so he has plausible deniability about what Donald Trump's proposals are actually going to be, and make his confirmation process a little less rough, which Democrats want to do. But the idea that maybe the most preeminent GOP policy guy on healthcare reform, who was very heartening when he was plucked up to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, that he's not really having any input on the policy side should be disconcerting.
Well, there's another disconcerting aspect of Tom Price, which is that these stories are beginning to bite about how he invested in healthcare companies that had, while he was crafting or dealing with legislation having to do with healthcare. And one story may be something you can deal with, but there are now two major stories, and there could be more, because this is the way it works. If you have somebody dead to rights, you start leaking it out bit by bit even before his hearing. Price is in trouble. I don't know if he's in enough trouble to lose three Republicans so that he goes down to failure in the Senate. But, he is a congressman, which means it's not like he has, innate support in the Senate. And myself having flippantly tweeted last night that him making a couple $1,000s off an investment in a medical devices company when he, of course, would, as a matter of policy and a matter of ideology, be opposed to the excessive regulation of medical devices companies, which is a solid view among, I would say, 100% view among Republicans, that the one of the disasters of Obamacare is the overregulation of medical devices companies that retards innovation and makes it much more difficult for companies to bring products to market that are unambiguously helping people. But nonetheless, Price did apparently invest in such a company and then supported a waiver of the medical devices legislation or section of Obamacare, as he has before. But then there are other stories about a $300,000 investment or a sweetheart deal with an Australian company that had a product that was coming to market. He's in a bit of trouble. So they're keeping him in the dark, and he may not end up getting confirmed anyway, which would be pretty striking. Someone in the end is not going to get confirmed. There's always somebody who doesn't get confirmed or who withdraws. It's not clear who that's going to be. Apparently, it's not going to be Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State nominee, because John McCain this morning signaled he would vote for him. And again, three Republicans would have to vote against Tillerson, Marco Rubio being one who will almost certainly vote against him, but he could end up being the only one. So that's the Tom Price story, unfortunately. But then we get to health insurance for all, and then we have this border adjustment fee issue. So I've been hearing about this now for 6 weeks or so. It's a sort of overly clever effort to impose a regulation on through the budget process without passing a tax or a tariff. as a way of satisfying Donald Trump. And the question is, what is the drama going on inside the Trump transition that would lead Trump to say he doesn't like this idea when apparently he told Paul Ryan that he did and would pursue it? And I think that we have here, we were talking about this, a sort of, it is the two faces of Trumpism. So I'm talking too much, but since this is my idea, I'm just going to ventilate and you guys have to sweat. So you have the desire to be a successful president just so that you don't look like an idiot and you look like you're better than anybody thought. And that could be Reince Priebus or the people around Reince Priebus and connected to Reince Priebus and Mike Pence, normal political professionals who view things as, you know, getting things done, getting legislation passed, getting things on your side, showing some results. And then you have he's a revolutionary who is going to drain the swamp, change the nature of American politics and world politics. And that's Steve Bannon, White House counselor, the guy who was essentially splitting responsibility for running the White House with Reince Priebus. And Bannon is a self-described Leninist revolutionary, and he believes that Trumpism is a battering ram to sort of break through all of the conventions and styles and ways of doing things over the last 40 or 50 years, both at home and abroad. And so I think you hear, Priebus in one voice of Trump, and then you hear Bannon in the other voice, and you don't know who's going to prevail.
I'm inclined to think that that the Bannon voice is very real and loud, especially considering things like you just mentioned regarding the potential for Trump to expand care from where it currently is with Obamacare. You know, as Bannon said in that interview with the Hollywood Reporter, a few months ago when he laid out his vision, he said conservatives are going to go crazy with the things that we're doing. He didn't say liberals are going to go crazy. He said conservatives are going to go crazy with all the stuff we have planned. I believe him, and that in combination with Trump's record as not being particularly conservative over the decades that he's weighed in on things is worrisome.
Well, that interview is also really illustrative of how he thinks, because he had spent a lot of time talking about how, he was going to wear some of the liberal caricatures of conservatives and Republicans as badges of honor. He was going to be the black hat that they had always suggested they were, that evil is good, and there was something about Satan in there. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was creepy. And that's, that's not good advice to give a president, to say, you're antagonizing the right people. That backfires on you. And we had two polls today from the Washington Post and ABC News, Langer Associates, and CNN ORC, both of which pegged Trump's favorability/approval at 40%. It's not good for a transition phase. It's not good for a president who expects his honeymoon to carry you over the threshold for those first 100 days and maybe get a major accomplishment passed. That's what every president wants. And the fact that Donald Trump seems to be getting advice that he's going to pound through this process and break up old allegiances and shatter consensuses and overturn the existing order in Washington with an approval rating of 40% just seems ripe for backfiring.
Well, I don't think it's just that. It's also that imagine, three Senate races go the other way and Republicans don't have the majority in the Senate, and you're looking at somebody who could not get a single nominee through. So he has the authority and the power, because of the Republican Party's institutional power, to work his will to some degree. But it's shaky. He is the weak link. Republicans in the House are very strong. Republicans with 52 seats in the Senate are reasonably strong, with the fact that the nuclear option, that the filibuster has been removed for executive confirmations. But otherwise, a guy at 40% is not that strong. And the other thing to say about 40% is he got 46% of the vote. So if these polls at their best have him at 43, that is, if the margin of error means that he could be as high as 43 or as low as 37. He's still off 3 points, meaning he doesn't – they're 10 – close to 8% or something like that of his supporters are now looking at him unfavorably. He's not growing. He's not getting support from people who were like sitting on the sidelines or who liked him or who didn't like him but are liking what they're hearing now, which is the ordinary pattern of transitions. He is polarizing the transition to his detriment.
And I don't hear anybody saying that on the pro-Trump side of the aisle. Even you know, reluctant supporters are being very incautious about how their person in office should proceed. Nobody's advising caution or discipline or prudence. Everybody's yelling at the press, for example, or citing rigged polling, as Donald Trump has today, in the rather insufficient polling and suboptimal polling over the course of the campaign, as an excuse to ignore these warning signs and just forge right ahead with the agenda. That's not good advice. Terrible advice.
Well, I mean, I was going to say, though, it is the obvious ready-made built-in response. He said something like the same people who polled during the campaign and said I wasn't popular are now telling
yeah, but it's intellectually vacuous. I mean, we're not talking about a normal polling error, which is what we experienced in the campaign. Everybody likes to say,
we didn't even experience a polling error in the campaign. The national polls had Hillary winning by 3.6 and she won by 2.9.
State level polls.
Okay. Well, anyway, the whole point is that she won within the margin of error of the polls, and there weren't enough state polls because no one had enough money to take enough state polls to have a sufficiency of data watching the three states that made him the winner in the final week.
This is going to be such a big problem, though, is not because Donald Trump is going to be tarnished. He's going to be president for the next 4 years, barring some disaster. It's for Republicans. Republicans are up in 2 years, and Republicans are going to start finding that they have to, as you said many times in the past, they're going to have to start creating some distance from this very unpopular president who's completely tone deaf and is forging ahead with an agenda nobody supports.
They are not going to have to create distance if he's successful. If he's successful, there are two reasons that they can't create distance. One of which is that he can basically aim a flamethrower at them. And while he's not nationally popular, he can certainly make life difficult for any individual Republican who wants to dare him by setting the dogs on them. That's one thing. The other thing is, yeah, he could be successful. But he can only be successful if he doesn't go to war with the Congress over what it is that they should pass. I mean, if he's going to give them a hard time about this border adjustment thing because he wants something more radical, then it's going to take 2 years for him to get whatever it is that he's more radical. He can't get it early. He can't claim credit for it. That's the bad advice. The bad advice is that it's fine to say we're going to swing for the fences, but if he makes it impossible for Paul Ryan to make any moves, and if he polarizes the House Republican caucus so that half of it is afraid of him and half of it just wants to show some success, and if he's going to like step on the possibility of repealing and replacing Obamacare by demanding universal health care, then the kind of chaos and nonsense chaos that's going to ensue is going to be crazy, and it is going to be this "you guys are in over your heads" thing. You don't know what the hell you're doing. So you were elected to drain the swamp, and you're a bunch of you're like the Keystone Cops. It's embarrassing to watch you, and that is the sort of thing that could really kill. I don't care. First of all, everybody who knows about politics knows that the senatorial map in 2018 is favorable for Republicans. There are a bunch of Democrats who are up in red states, who won in 2010 and 2012 in red states, and are going to have a rough road to hoe. And there aren't that many Republicans up, but like as was the case in 2010 and 2014, if the atmosphere for your party turns negative, the map is really favorable to you stuff in the world isn't going to help you. I mean, if there's a national move against Trumpism or against the Republicans, there we've seen waves, midterm waves in 2006, 2010, and 2014. You know what those are? Every midterm. So the idea that the 2018 midterm is going to be nice, and they've been waves against the party in power. So the idea that 2018 is going to be good to Trump just because, as it happens, you know, structurally it's favorable is a fool's idea. Like, you can't presume that that's true.
But I do think there's a possibility that if he gets into office and then as president says, okay, we are going to expand health care for everyone under some sort of Trump-branded Obamacare, it could be popular among Americans. And then what do the Republicans do?
But what does it mean? It's nonsense. It's the same problem.
Oh, wrongly popular, but it could be, of course.
No, because he has to show results. In other words, first of all, he has to repeal Obamacare because he said, I'm going to repeal Obamacare. So he can't repeal Obamacare, and then Republicans aren't going to craft a bill that replaces Obamacare with Obamacare. That doesn't make any sense. They're not going to vote for it. I mean, you know, you can get the entire party can become Trump robots and you're not going to get enough people to vote for it. And what, the Democrats are going to save it because it's called Trump Care? That's not going to happen. They're going to watch it die and say, "Oh, I'm really enjoying watching you take away health care from 20 million people."
For the record, I don't know if he meant it or not. Obama did say in one of his gazillion exit interviews that he would be happy to endorse a Trump Care that expanded care.
Yeah, except that the Trump Care that expands care might say have something in there about how you don't have to pay for contraception. That alone,
Obamacare
will be the end
that.
Of it. Well, it had that, and then they rewrote the reg.
It was a regulation.
But what I'm saying is, you put something like that in, any single deviation from Obamacare gives every Democrat the right to say, "Well, this isn't Obamacare. This is terrible. This is awful. How can you do this?"
All of this is foreshadowing something that is a dynamic that I think we should probably be looking for more actively, because it sounds like it's going to be a big deal, which is a real decision time for members of the conservative commentary class as to where you really fall down on this, you know, on this divide. Right now we're papering over the divisions between the incoming Trump White House and the Congress, the Republican Congress, and those – there's only so far you can go with that, and people are going to have to pick sides. And I don't know whether it's going to fall down on policy grounds.
I think
it's going to fall much more on affectation.
We don't know if they're going to have to pick sides, because this could all be bloviation. It could all be nothing. It could all in the end be that they're going to structure the bills that they're going to structure, and he'll vote for whatever Paul Ryan tells him to vote for.
Well, we do know there are members of this White House that do consider themselves revolutionary members of, you know, a class that is going to break up these, you know, sclerotic institutions in Washington, and they're not going to stick around very long if it ends up being Paul Ryan's administration.
Well, we'll see how long they stick around. People don't leave the White House unless they, you know, they love it. They love going to the White House mess. They love getting to know the Secret Service. They love all of it, revolutionary or not. So it's not so easy to get them out, and they may be sidelined or they may not. And we just don't know, because, again, we're talking about everything that he says before he's president. And it's very hard to know what that means once he becomes president. But it does mean that, you know, his recklessness continues apace, and he thinks that that's part of his – that's a feature, not a bug. And it may well be. It's going to be less of a feature – than a bug when, you know, he's negotiating with members of his own party on where they're going to go with something, which is, generally speaking, not the way this is supposed to work. And it's not supposed to work that way because it doesn't work structurally. But he could change. But he probably won't. But he could. Okay. Issue two. NATO.
That was very John McLaughlin.
Yeah. I was on the show a couple times. He was crazy, by the way. He's dead. He was a total maniac.
He
should rest in peace, and it was a great show, but man, was he a nut. Anyway, so issue two, Obama talks NATO, and Angela Merkel goes bananas. So, Abe, Noah, No, I was in the middle of writing about this. So no, you, I'm throwing it to you. So what is going on? What did he say to the German paper and to the Times of London?
Well, he didn't say anything that he really hasn't said in the past. Nor is he saying anything with regard to the EU that is especially controversial. If you're a conservative American, if you're a European, particularly one who's maybe center right and is fighting for their political life, it's pretty detrimental. He had expressed his usual skepticism toward NATO. It was actually rather toned down from something that he had said during the campaign. During the campaign, he was openly flirting with leaving Estonia out to dry if they were attacked by Russia and invoked Article 5. I mean, he was going really far out there. This time, he was kind of scaling that back a little bit, saying NATO's important, but their mission is obsolete. Enough to give Europeans jitters, but sort of relatively in line with what he has said in the past and in line with his more standard boilerplate statements about the importance of NATO from Republicans and his members, nominees to head cabinet positions, James Mattis over at DOD and Mike Pompeo over at CIA, et cetera. At the same time, though, the reaction in Europe has been much more nervous and frightened and frustrated. He called the EU a vehicle for Germany, just really an institution that exists to keep Germany as the preeminent power in the continent. And that's a debatable position. It's arguable. And certainly conservatives have a lot of problems with the supranational bureaucratic institution that the EU has become, a hyper-regulatory body. But Europeans do have a different perspective that needs to be considered. Not only is Angela Merkel facing the fight of her political career, but she's, you know, Europeans do have fond memories of the European coal and steel community. The nature of what this institution was designed to do, with a lot of American input, covert and overt, was designed to tether these two, you know, major warring parties in Europe together, France and Germany, make them aligned and reliant upon each other.
Yeah, but to be fair, like, that was part of the common market idea, and the EU itself has taken this idea and stretched it beyond the bounds of anything that is even remotely.
Again, this is an American conservative position.
It's a European conservative position. It is the position of Brexit. It's how Brexit
happened
in Europe.
Well, that's a far-right position, though. I mean,
The British position on Brexit is not a far right position.
The European position on Brexit.
No, I'm sorry. I meant the British or the English.
The advocacy during the campaign, the Leave campaign, was very much a hard right position.
No, that is simply remember, don't give in to the hype proposition here. Simple fact of the matter is that more people voted in England for Leave than have ever voted for anything in English history. That is the nature of that referendum, and it was supported by conservative intellectuals and by populists and by a lot of different people, and it won by 4 percentage points. And you have a prime minister now, Theresa May, who was a quiet. She was sort of a semi-supporter, but not
an opponent. She was a vocal opponent.
Well, okay, so and she is now basically today said we want a clean Brexit. It is time for us to break. We're not going to try to make something where we're in the EU and not in the EU. And why? Because the British position, the English position on Brexit, despite the efforts in the weeks after its success to say that, you know, if you could only vote again, everyone would vote against it, is solidifying into the notion that this is the future. But I'm just saying, Trump attacking the EU for being a, you know, for being a sort of something that is largely designed for the benefit of Germany is complicated and wrong, because of course the EU has now become a slave to the poorer nations of Europe and not the richer ones.
Well, this is the point of my piece, which I think everybody's sort of missing the point for this minutia about the value and the benefit of these institutions, which are really badly in need of reform. And I would include NATO in that. It's that we don't look at the European reaction, which is rapidly abandoning Atlanticism. You have the British public that is now really saying we're on our own. Angela Merkel is saying we're on our own. England is very concerned that they're leading a charge against Russia. when it comes to sanctions, and they're being abandoned by Washington, and they have a right to be concerned about that. They are being abandoned by Washington.
Yeah, well, you're mixing apples and oranges here, because the defense posture of Europe is different from the economic posture of Europe. And the future of NATO, it's also Trump who is mixing together the future of NATO and the future of the EU. There's literally no reason. The two, NATO pre-exists the EU. NATO has its own reason for being that has literally nothing to do with European integration whatsoever. It is a, you know, it is a treaty alliance to protect the West against the East in Europe, right? That's essentially what it existed to be. And as it turns out, it's more necessary than we thought it was going to be after the end of the Cold War.
But that's a sentiment that doesn't necessarily – we're monopolizing this thing, Abe. I'm going to throw it to you in a second. But this is a sentiment now that has not been shared by the American public for a long time. The American public is very skeptical of America's relationships, financial and defense related with Europe. That has not been the case for American presidents. It is now. And it is the case that Europe is now saying, look, we got to provide for our own in the event that we are on our own.
Look,
and that's a sentiment sort of erodes the necessity of Atlanticism, which has been consensus for 50 years.
Again, I'm not entirely sure I agree. In other words, the best possible way to look at what's happened here, you know, that's not that Trump is a Russian agent and working to destroy NATO to help Putin, which is the worst possible way to look at it and, you know, most horrifying possible way to look at it. Is that, you know, if his pushing means that, you know, the countries of Europe in a desperate effort to save NATO decide to pony up to 2% of their GDP on defense, then he can walk around saying, I saved NATO, just like he says, I saved jobs in Ohio. You know, he can say, look, I said we got a bad deal from NATO and I scared them and they agreed that they needed to up their defense you know, giving to 2%, which is the treaty obligation, and so I saved NATO.
Look,
NATO, and that is the thing that you should hope for, is that's where this goes. And it might, you know, if they're really scared.
Save NATO. NATO's not in danger unless we make it in danger. That's like putting a gun to somebody's head and forcing them to do something and say, look, I saved your life.
Look, if we believe that
he breaks NATO, we're the only one who can break NATO.
Precisely, and that's what he's threatening to do.
Right, so if he, by saying I'm breaking NATO, gets, you know, Italy to put up 2% of its GDP to pay for defense, then he will
look. First of all, if he is really, you know, sees everything as a deal, we can hope that it's an opening position, it's an opening bid, designed to get the effect John describes.
The American position has and should remain that NATO is its own value, regardless of anybody puts any money to
should
defense.
Or not should is no longer the point.
We're only going to defend those members of NATO that put up their 2% defense is betrayed by the fact that he suggested that Estonia wasn't deserving of the collective defense provision, which is one of the five nations that puts up 2% defense.
Again, you are acting as though this is a considered developed position. What I'm saying is that Atlanticists can hope, and Angela Merkel is not helping because her political instincts appear to be the political instincts of Hillary Clinton plus Martin O'Malley right now. I mean, she's got just her most horrendous political instinct is to say, because Trump's threatening her, we're screwed, we better go off on our own, everything is over with.
But this does have to be taken alongside what he said about Putin and Russia over the weekend as well, about possibly getting rid of sanctions
tied to the
nuclear arsenal. I mean, so it, you know, his confusion leads to sort of all sorts. It has consequences.
Yeah, right? It may not be a considered position, but we have no choice but to take him at his word, which is why I think Europe has been so, you know, run up to a boiling point here over these comments, which are legitimately nowhere near as disturbing as the stuff he was saying in the campaign, because he's going to be president in a few days. He's being judged by a different standard.
Look, the simple fact of the matter is that the Europeans have acted irresponsibly toward their responsibility toward the common defense and toward their own union. The threats to the future of the EU have been visible, vocal, and present since, you know, for the last 10 years, and they were like ostriches and pretended that they could either bully their way through or sort of just let it all pass. And obviously that's not going to happen, number one. Number two, this whole crisis in NATO is entirely unnecessary and is a species of Trump, and it's a terrible thing. That said, there are possibilities within it that can save it by appealing to his own vanity, which is what Abe meant as a deal maker. Like, if he can say, man, I just made the most fantastic deal. It wasn't really what I intended, but I can walk around just like I said, I saved Carrier, I saved NATO.
Look, he said, look, didn't I do a great service by putting the birther stuff to rest?
Yeah.
By getting Obama to show his birth certificate.
I mean, look, I don't hold out. It's not like I hold out hope that this is the way things are going to go. I hold out very little hope, period. I myself am not in an optimistic frame. I tried to be in an optimistic frame, but, you know, then I read. You can't help reading. So I read this thing that he said yesterday about how he doesn't believe in heroes. He doesn't like the idea of heroes. He doesn't like the idea of heroism, but sure, his father was really good at business. So I'm thinking about that, and I'm thinking, oh, really, you don't believe in heroes, and you're about to, like, be the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Armed Forces, which we're basically, we ask, you know, tens of thousands of people every day to risk their lives right now in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in the fight against ISIS, all over the place. Those people are heroes just getting up in the morning with their guns. I know they chose it. I know they weren't drafted and they're self-selected. But the notion that you can say that when the only thing that you have to know is that you're in a position where you are potentially sending people to their deaths every morning that you have them deployed is so horrifying that I can't. It's just, you know, it makes you despair, or it makes me despair anyway. Trying to hope that, you know, reason will prevail, and this kind of bizarre Randian position that, you know, I'm the only hero, I'm my own hero, and that's all that matters. And anyone else who worships heroes is a slave, which is the Rand idea. Like, you're not supposed to worship other people. But, I mean, you know, there are heroes every day. There are heroes who, like, save people, jump into icy rivers to save children.
And, yeah, and the thing that makes heroes is that they're defending and championing a virtue. So if he doesn't – I think we can read into this by, you know, he doesn't – what does he think is worth defending? What virtue is worth dying for?
Is it worth defending – existing institutions that prevent conflict? Is the prevention of conflict itself a virtue? Is conflict beneficial?
Well, obviously, as a matter of character, he does not believe the prevention of conflict is a virtue. He is addicted to conflict. He invents conflict where there is none in order to, for whatever reason you can deeply psychologically examine.
Therein lies everybody's concern about antipathy toward the most successful defense posture that history has ever given rise to.
Yeah, well, there's reason to be concerned. So I'm offering a hopeful scenario based only on the notion that it makes no – that despair is not an option. I mean, despair is an option if you feel it and you can't get out of it, but it's not really a policy option. Entropy, you know, sometimes when you don't have commitment to things, entropy takes over. So it's much harder to destroy NATO than you think. And so it's much harder to pull out of treaty. It's much harder to destroy NAFTA than you think. NAFTA can only be repealed by another treaty. I mean, you can't just end NAFTA. That's not the way it works. So, you know, despite the fact that that's what he sold a lot of people, you can't override, you know, the law and the Constitution, fortunately.
Realizing we're going over on this topic, I don't know if it would be all that difficult to destroy NATO. NATO exists only for the common defense. And once that common defense provision is broken, invoked, and not honored, right, the alliance ceases to exist.
Right. But it has to be invoked. But it has to be invoked and then broken.
And that's the thinking is that we're never going to see it invoked by another power that's not the United States. Turkey, for example, one of its jets was shot down in Syria in 2012. It invoked NATO's Article 4, which is a consultation period, a precursor to the invocation of Article 5. And we believe that the Obama administration leans very heavily on Turkey to not invoke Article 5. there's the possibility that there could be enough diplomatic leverage over the Baltic states in the event that they do perceive their sovereignty to be violated to an extent that they would invoke Article 5, that maybe Donald Trump can persuade them not to do it. But if they did, and London and Berlin and Paris and Washington said, why are we going to go to war for Tallinn, which could go nuclear? Who cares about Tallinn? The alliance ceases to exist.
Well, of course it does. But that could always have been the case. I mean, I don't think it would have been the case. I think, you know, I mean, it's hard to know. In 2009... would Barack Obama have gone to war over Tallinn? That's a very that's an interesting call. I don't know that 2009 Obama goes to war over Tallinn. I mean, that's the problem with, you know, the expansion of NATO. When we expanded NATO in the 90s and the early 2000s, we also expanded the possibility of its breakup in that sense, because it was obvious that the original core NATO signatories, any attack on them was literally, that was the World War II, those were the World War II allies. Any attack on them was an attack on, you know, the countries that saved civilization, in effect. And so there was no dispute. And I think even now would be no dispute. I mean, if Russia tried to go to war with Germany, even Trump wouldn't stand for that. You know what I mean? So I'm just saying, you're right, but I mean, then it has to be invoked. And if it has to be invoked, then that's not the standard I'm talking about. I mean, if Trump wants to withdraw from NATO, withdrawing from NATO in the absence of a huge crisis is not so easy to do. That's where entropy starts setting in. I mean, there's a lot of institutions, logistics, you know, bases. Where do people, where do soldiers go when they're not on NATO bases? They've got to, we've got to find a place for them in the United States. There aren't necessarily, you know, there's housing. I mean, who knows? It's all silly to talk about it in this way. It's only silly to talk about it this way because we have to. Which is another reason for some despair. But so I think the last thing we want to talk about is sort of silly but kind of funny, which is Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus ending after 170 years of service, declaring that they will no longer tour with their three-ring circus and animals and all of that. And it's kind of a startling end to what may have been the first major showbiz act in the United States and possibly the world, like huge showbiz act. Possible to describe the importance of the circus in the 19th century. That was the thing that came to town when literally nobody had any entertainment ever, of any kind, ever. All they had were Sunday sermons. That was it. There was no entertainment. So the circus came to town and, you know, people just, it was the one time in the year that you got to kick your heels up.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think it's significant. It's sort of one of those things that the second I read it, I said, oh, of course the time's up on that. You know, it seems so yesteryear as I was reading it. But it's an enormous American institution.
There's some debate over why this happened, right? There's, according to Barnum Bailey's, they got rid of elephants a year ago under pressure from animal rights groups. And subsequently, the demand for their performances went down to the point where they no longer made ends meet, and they dissolved as a result of not being financially viable anymore. John, I think you brought up earlier that there were other circuses that had gone under.
Well, Big Apple Circus, which is a New York-based circus, declared bankruptcy earlier this year. But, you know, the thing is that it's not like if you want to go see a circus, you can't go see a circus. Like Cirque du Soleil, which is a billion-dollar company, has three or four shows in Vegas, and it's got a show, it's got a play on Broadway, it's got stuff in Canada, it's got stuff all over the world. It's just that it's not touring. It doesn't come to your town. It's not like this signature moment. Now, some of that is just nostalgia talking about this, because that's not the way we entertain ourselves anymore. And it's a good memory of the world that was, and of course this phenomenon that, you know, people would run away with the circus because they lived in some farm town in Idaho or somewhere, and they never literally had anything to do with their lives, and they were just going to go off and you know have to go work on their father's farm and marry somebody local and all this, and they would run off with the circus to do whatever just because they had, it was the only way to get out.
Now you two have kids and I don't. Do kids in 2017 still find the circus entertaining?
Yeah, I've taken my kids to the circus a couple of times. I don't find it. I hated it as a kid. I didn't like seeing it, and I didn't particularly find the animal acts that thrilling. But I'm not.
I have this
with
this
it.
Vision.
It's long. It's very
right.
long.
I have this vision in my head of, like, you know, a little kid with his little kid iPhone you know, playing games while elephants are stacking up in front of him.
It depends on your age, I guess. I mean, my son is just over 2, and he can't get enough animals. So he would die for an animal act.
He might die for an animal act, but are you willing to spend $300 taking him to an animal act?
$300?
Well, if you're taking him and your wife and the three of you go, and you got to get you got a babysitter for the baby, or like you're at like $300.
Yeah, well, I got to pay $300, but what am I going to now? I'm going to Paw Patrol live at MSG.
Right.
I mean, that's the kind of kitsch. Whatever's on television, mm-hmm. the live version of whatever that mm-hmm. vapid program is that yeah. that's what I have to yeah. suffer through.
Well, we can all go to the state fair and we can see giant, we can all somehow get to the state fair in New Jersey. It's not that far from where you live and where we live, and there's always a big fat 2,000-pound pig, and someone's pulling a tractor and all of that. It's just not an elephant.
Right.
Like the specialty was the elephant, I guess.
Seems to me. I mean, the sort of
get a fried Twinkie.
The cruelty angle aside, it seems that the circus sort of depended on this shared acceptance that sort of innocence could be entertaining.
There's this fanaticism around animal rights too that I think I have to speak up for, because nobody else is saying anything about it. Not too long ago, something stuck in my craw, which was the notion expressed actually by Dr. Charles Krauthammer, who correctly said that we've been evolving as a species. And one of the things that we'll look back on in 100 years is how anybody could have treated animals the way we do. And not merely as entertainment aspects, but as pets and as food. And the notion that our species will evolve beyond that sort of primal, does husbandry and the notion that we have to consume protein, it strikes me as sort of utopian in a bizarre fashion. I don't know if these are ideals that we should be inculcating in our society, because they're sort of creating these conditions where we're destroying things that are good. And the circus is among them. If this was really financially no longer viable and they're just using their elephants as an excuse, then that's sort of malicious, and that poisons the debate. But I don't think they're lying. I think a lot of the appeal died with this, notion that they were abusing these animals. And that's a very debatable position.
Look, I think the other problem here that you face is this inevitable notion that inevitably America, people are going to give up, eating animals is all nice and well and good, except you have the phenomenon of the deer population of the United States. So what happened when it turned out that deer hunting became wildly unpopular and was drastically limited? Well, what happened was the deer population increased, particularly in the Northeast. The deer are starving. There's not enough food for them. And they are a carrier of a very, very, very threatening disease to people through the deer tick, Lyme disease, which is, just absolutely devastating. It's not fatal.
I got the vaccine and then I got the disease. We live in Western New Jersey. You get it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not fatal, but people spend years in sort of like agony over it, or exhaustion or whatever.
Paralysis.
And this was an effort to do something humane. So now you have these phenomena where you have these weekends in which it's like the movie The Purge, where suddenly there's this one weekend in which you can kill all the deer you can possibly lay your hands on.
Right.
And it's like a slaughterhouse, because they need to cull the herd.
The same is true of predators. They're reintroducing some predators now, and we've seen the resurgence of coyote populations and bear populations in the Northeast. I'm sure it's just as worse out west with the gray wolf population, for example. I mean, this is the sort of thing that they were overhunted and poorly stewarded as populations, but there's also some management that needs to go on.
And also, there's this countercurrent in the culture where, while veganism is perhaps on the rise, or vegetarianism, or, people are advocating for it, there's now a growing body of evidence and a growing population of people who say, no, we absolutely need animal protein and fat in our diets. We need it for life. So
one way of looking at this morally is that the idea of creating a moral equivalency between humans protecting humans and humans protecting animals, that we animal rights activists are more interested in the, you know, lives of animals than they are in the lives of people, and saving babies from diseases. So by using animal testing in order to find out whether drugs work. And it's one thing to say you shouldn't wear fur or belts or whatever, because that's a misuse of animals. But it's quite another to say that using animals for sustenance in ways that are healthy, and using animals to help you cure diseases, because that is what is good for people, and people are the, you know, dominating species on the planet for a good reason, is another. So, I mean, here, I'll give you one. We'll end on this. We'll end on my fish. So I have a betta fish. My daughter is a betta fish. Riptide, the betta fish. It's been alive now for 10 months, which is pretty amazing. And you can't have another fish with Riptide, because if you put the fish in the bowl, they would kill each other. They're Siamese fighting fish, and they would literally rip each other to shreds. So it swims alone in its bowl. It's like, my God, what kind of life is this? It's horrible. But on the other hand, its brain is the size of an amoeba. And on the other, you look at this fish and you think, if this fish were like in the waters off of Thailand for 6 hours, it would have been eaten. Like, I mean, it's a tiny little thing. Another fish comes up, opens its mouth. 6 hours, that maybe 3 hours, 4 hours, you know. So it's terrible to have this fish in a bowl, except consider the alternative. That's all I can say. And the alternative now is for you to get back to work or to go play with your kids as you get home. This has been the Commentary Magazine podcast. Go to commentarymagazine.com, as I said, a few free reads, and then you get our we ask you to subscribe. For Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.